Good morning. How are we doing? Well, welcome to Daniel class. Have you guys turn on over to Daniel chapter 7. Really excited today. Get a chance to finish up the chapter here. You know, as long as you guys, don't take us too far off track. You know, that's a joke. It's always me. Jennifer's my witness, you know. She's like, this guy is not following his notes. Okay, great. Daniel chapter 7, verse 15. As for me, Daniel, my spirit was distressed within me. The visions in my mind kept alarming me. And I approached one of those who were standing by and began asking him the exact meaning of all of this. So he's seen four beasts, three of them more like animals we would recognize, the fourth dreadful and terrifying. Then presented before the Ancient of Days, and God pronounces judgment. Then right after that, the beasts are judged. Extension of life is given to them, but their dominion is ripped away and given to Jesus in verses 13 and 14 when the Son of Man is presented before the Ancient of Days at the consummation of the ages, where he is given dominion, glory, and a kingdom. So Daniel's trying to figure out what's going on here. And, a major thing that makes Daniel 7 really different from Daniel 2 is, one of the toes in Daniel 2 doesn't break off and start having an entire rest of a chapter dedicated to it, you know. So when you're looking in Daniel 7 here, we see a picture of what the church age is going to look like. That man's authority and man's power, those who are held captive by Satan to do his will, okay, are going to continue to wage war during the church age. And the way that is explained in Daniel 7 is that this horn that comes and takes its place as God persecutes the saints, uttering all kinds of blasphemous things. So in verse 19, Daniel says, I desired to know the exact meaning of the fourth beast, which was different than all the others, exceedingly dreadful, and its teeth of iron and its claws of bronze, and which devoured, crushed, and trampled down the remainder with its feet. And the meaning of the 10 horns that were on its head, and the other horn which came up, before which three of them fell, namely that horn which had eyes and a mouth uttering great boasts, and which was larger in appearance than its associates. I kept looking, and that horn was waging war with the saints and overpowering them until the Ancient of Days came and judgment was passed in favor of the saints of the highest one. And the time arrived when the saints took possession of the kingdom. Daniel wants to know what's going on with this horn. It's waging war with the saints. So we know that this is the church age. From that day of Pentecost, right, 30 AD, up until, you know, current time, present time. And we are going to be and continue to be in the church age until the Ancient of Days comes and executes judgment on that horn. And that's what we're seeing here in Daniel chapter 7. So, verse 23, he says, as for the 10 horns out of this kingdom, 10 kings will arise and another will arise after them. And he will be different from the previous ones and will subdue three kings. He will speak out against the Most High, wear down the saints of the Highest One, and will intend to make alterations in times and in law, and they will be given into his hand for a time, times, and half a time. So again, verse 25 confirming for us that this conflict between the horn, which I would say is the remnant of the fourth beast, okay, the conflict between the horn and the church, the holy ones, is indeed during the church age. And so we confirmed that last week. And, you know, how would you confirm that? Well, if Jesus's ministry is 3.5 years, and the prophecy in Daniel is 7, then you need another 3.5 to complete that week prophecy. Does that make sense? You've got this prophecy in Daniel about this week, and it's a symbolic week. The first 3.5 are fulfilled through Jesus's 3.5 year long ministry. So that means we're left with 3.5 to complete the 7. So what else is 3.5? Well, the book of Revelation calls the church age 3.5 years. That's pretty convenient. Then we read, and if you want to, and you weren't here yesterday, I mean, you can get your, you can close Facebook and open up your calculator, okay? In the book of Revelation, we confirmed that when Satan was beat by Jesus, when did Satan get finally booted from heaven by Jesus? Okay, at his glorification, when Jesus brings the blood of the sacrifice, cleanses it, Revelation's very clear that there was now no longer a place found for Satan in heaven, and he was booted, okay? And the great picture that you get from Revelation 12 is that since then, Satan has stopped trying to thwart God's entire plan. He cannot prevail against the kingdom, okay? All he can do is snatch as many individuals as he can on his way down. So I kind of picture the devil as someone who is currently falling off the edge of the cliff because Satan, or because Jesus has given him the final boot, and he knows that he's headed to the bottomless pit, and all he can do is try to grab as many people on his way down because that's his character and who he is. Okay? In that context, and again, this is all overview. Okay? So if you haven't been here the last couple of weeks, you know, it might be going a little quick here, but in that picture and that overview that we get in Revelation 12, it calls this time period the church age, 1,260 days. You know? Well, if you take 1,260 days and divide it by 360, which is how many days are in the Jewish calendar, you come up to 3.5, 3.5. Very convenient. And then Revelation 12 also uses the same language, time, times, and half a time, which is 3.5. Don't actually have the chapter off the top of my head, but then the book of Revelation will later refer to the church age as 42 months. Take that and divide it by 12. What do you get? 3.5. So, confirms for us then that the horn, that is a remnant of the fourth beast, who was what? Who is the fourth beast a representative of? Rome. So this horn that's a remnant of the Roman Empire is now waging war with the church during the church age, which is from 30 AD until now, and until Jesus should come back in judgment. Okay? So that's kind of how we're going to really focus our class on today is that time period. But again, just elaborating here on the end of verse 25, that time, times, and half a time is confirming for us when this conflict is taking place between the horn and the holy ones. Verse 26, the court will sit for judgment, and his dominion, this is the horn here, will be taken away, annihilated, and destroyed forever. Then the sovereignty, the dominion, and the greatness of all the kingdoms under the whole heaven will be given to the people of the saints of the highest one. His kingdom will be an everlasting kingdom, and all the dominions will serve and obey him. At this point, the revelation ended. As for me, Daniel, my thoughts were greatly alarming me, and my face grew pale, and I kept the matter to myself. Thankful that he wrote it down, because we have it. So, okay. You have this really cool picture of Satan waging war against God in the Old Testament. You know, how did he do that? Well, you know, he largely did that by attacking God's people directly with armies. specifically targeting the line of David, because the prophecies were clear that from David would come a king who would rule on the throne forever. So if you're Satan, you're going to try to kill David, David's family, and his lineage, right? We just read in Matthew 2 when murmurings are coming along that the Messiah that was prophesied of in the Old Testament has been born. Because that's what Christ means, right? Messiah. Just the Greek equivalent of the anointed one from the Hebrew. So, you know, Satan hears that the anointed Messiah has been born. So what does he do? Well, you know, he has Herod ascertain when the star appeared and figure out where he's at so he could kill him. That's how That's how Satan fought against God. Now, when Jesus ascends to heaven and cleanses it and gives Satan the boot, Satan now knows he cannot win against God's plan. He stopped trying to stop God's plan and switched to just trying to pull as many holy ones away as he can. That's why the horn is waging war with the holy ones. Okay? But with that switch came a switch in Satan's tactics, right? Satan's not raising up armies and destroying entire countries trying to stop God's plan anymore, because he can't. All he can do is seduce and entice and tempt you to choose the world over Christ. That's all he can do. So that's why you see this change in the way that this war is taking place. I would argue that the horn is a remnant of the fourth beast, because Rome never fully ceased to exist. It just morphed into a church. Okay, so that's how the beast, you know, judgment is made on that physical kingdom. Yeah, sure enough, Rome doesn't exist as a physical kingdom, right? But, you just got to follow the money, right? Isn't that what they always say? Yeah. If you really want to know what's going on, you just got to follow the money. I mean, that's how I vote for, Supreme Court justices. I don't know how you do it, but I just follow the money, Well, they're supposed to be nonpartisan, the judges, right? But I would like a judge that's going to support as many conservative scriptural concepts as possible, right? I think the majority of you would like that. So how do I know which one's going to do that? Well, I just find out who's funding them. That's the easiest way to do it. So anybody have any idea where all of Rome's gold went when the empire ended? Where'd the money go? It's in the Vatican, where the Roman church is. So he's got to follow the money, right? So, well, that's interesting. Let's follow this through. Take us over to Acts chapter 2 real quick. Really, really like this verse. Verse 24. God raised him up again, putting an end to the agony of death, since it was impossible for him to be held in its power. Okay. Jesus dies. God makes him become sin who knew no sin, right? And he descends to Hades, where all men who die go. And it says it was impossible for death to keep him. So when the Son of Man comes up from Hades, leading captive a host of captives, everything changed in that moment. The course of the spiritual battle in the heavenly places changed course forever. Okay. So Satan's got to switch up his game here. If you go to 1 Thessalonians... have us just kind of think here for a second. I said first, I mean 2 Thessalonians. I'm like Kevin, I just know where it's at on the page. I think you were the one that said that Thursday evening, yeah. let's begin reading here. Verse 1. Chapter 2. Chapter 2, verse 1. Now we request you, brethren, with regard to the coming of our Lord Jesus Christ and our gathering together to him, that you not be quickly shaken from your composure or disturbed, either by a spirit or a message or a letter, as if from us, to the effect that the day of the Lord has come. Okay. That can be a little wordy. Let's see if we can unpackage that. Okay, concerning Jesus' return and us being gathered to him, don't be scared that it's already happened and you missed it, even if you got a letter that said it was from me saying you missed it. Okay? I mean, could you imagine if this congregation, for some whatever reason, thought we had missed, the coming of Christ? We would be rethinking a lot of things about the book of Revelation. Okay? And you'd be shaking in your boots. Okay, so he's reassuring them that this Jesus is returning. It has not happened yet. Okay, verse 3, let no one in any way deceive you. It will not come unless the apostasy comes first. So what does that word apostasy mean? And it's not like falling away. It's like the great falling away, right? So I want you to think about this. You know, Jesus dies and it says death itself couldn't even hold him. It was impossible, you know, for death to hold Jesus, Acts 2 said. Okay, so the Son of Man ascends, leading captive a host of captives. And the nature and direction of the spiritual battle changes course forever. Satan is kicked and booted out of heaven. He cannot win against God. Okay, a man lived perfect on this life. Proved that it can be done. And that God's plan is still good. And that God is righteous. Okay, so everything changes when Jesus ascends to heaven. Now, he's not coming back. Okay. Guys, he says, don't worry. You don't have to worry about missing Jesus' return because there's going to be this great, great falling away that takes place first. So, 30 AD, 3,000 souls are added that day to the church and it continues to grow. Where's the church by 100 AD? Where's the church by 300 AD? It's gone. Now, Jesus' kingdom is always. And I'm not saying there weren't Christians on the earth. But you read the history, you read the literature. The Catholics are the universal church. And they have control over the thrones of man. You know. I mean, you couldn't even divorce your wife unless the Pope said it was okay. Now, I don't have a problem with the emphasis on not divorcing your wife, but I'm trying to show you, I mean, even them kings themselves couldn't go to war or divorce their wife unless the Pope said it was okay. Okay, so who's got the power? It's fine. You know, look, I try to give us pictures here. Did Rome end or did it just morph into a church? Okay, so great falling away. How many of us, you know, semi-familiar with Restoration Church history in America? Okay. Ballpark, round figure, century, when does that happen in this country? Pre-Civil War. Yeah. Yeah, 1800s. Yeah. Technically, right at the end of the 1700s, but the majority of the work that was done in the early 1800s, a lot of these guys coming over from Scotland, 1803. Okay, I think Barton Stone, probably the only American-born Restoration leader, the rest of them from Scotland. So, you know, they're coming over here for other reasons. You got guys like Alexander Campbell, okay, Thomas Campbell, Walter Scott. You got these guys coming over from Scotland for other various reasons, some religious, some health, you know. And, you know, they're looking at kind of the state of the church here in America, and they're realizing a really great need to restore the church back to the Bible. So we are going to name, pattern, structure, and build the church according to the Bible. Okay, and we're not going to use the doctrines of men to do that. Okay, this has just happened in my own life pretty frequently recently. I have probably had at least 3 or 4 times in the last month people ask me, ask my wife, or ask you guys directly, why doesn't he call himself a pastor? You know, I'm involved in the Homeschool Nights organization, which is a Christian-based organization. And, you know, a lot of these people, I mean, they work in their own congregations themselves, and they're getting to know me, and I'm the preacher at the congregation on 48th, right? And they can't figure out why I'm not the pastor. Well, what do you do, you know? Yeah. I'm not the head pastor, not the youth pastor, the family pastor, the executive pastor. You know, I mean, what do you do? Okay. Well, that's one of them things when it comes to the restoration of the ancient order is, you know, we've got to get our definitions and the structure and the pattern of our church in accordance with the Bible. Okay. And I am not a pastor. Okay. That's not what the Bible teaches. 1800s. So that means the seeds, man, if anybody has the date of the Council of Nicaea off the top of their head, you got to give that to me. What's that? 325. And that's where you get the language for Trinity finally gets cemented in literature, is during that Council of Nicaea. So 300 AD, the Catholic Church firmly rooted and planted on the earth. Where's the church according to the scriptures? For 1,500 years. Look, we're kind of basing a lot of this off of literature, which is how you study any kind of history. So we don't know the exact, but the point is, man, I mean, we don't have much, if anything. And I understand that there are many different divisions inside the Baptist congregations, but the Baptists will tell you that they founded this country, if you talk to them. So your founding fathers, you know, they're going to claim the founding fathers, the majority of them Baptist. Okay, they're going to say, right? So Where's the church according to the scriptures? It's not until Walter Scott, you know, says, you know, you gotta be immersed for the forgiveness of your sins to receive the Holy Spirit. 1,500 years. That's a pretty big falling away, huh? So in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, verse 3, in a way to reassure the brethren that Christ has not come and they missed it, is he says, first, this great falling away is going to take place. And I'm trying to help you understand the nature of this falling away. Okay. When it comes to literature, we don't see the preaching and the teaching and the practicing of immersion for remission of sins in the Holy Spirit until the 1800s. That's a 1,500 year gap. So it's not going to happen in verse 3 until the great falling away comes and a man of lawlessness is revealed. So there's this man of lawlessness. Verse 4, he opposes and exalts himself above every so-called God or object of worship. He takes his seat in the temple of God, displaying himself as being God. Do you not remember that while I was still with you, I was telling you these things? And you know what restrains him now, so in the last times he will be revealed. Oh, so, I got to keep moving here. I want you guys to go over to 2 John. There's going to be this man of lawlessness who's revealed. Now, the majority of people teach this man of lawlessness as being who? How would the majority of people, you know, kind of teach and believe this? I guess it's not, I mean, it's a number of things, but they like to connect the man of lawlessness to the Antichrist, right? Okay. This is one of my, you know, favorite things to show people because it just completely explodes their brains. Okay, 2 John. I hope I said 2 John. Let's look at verse 7. Many deceivers have gone out into the world, those who do not acknowledge Jesus Christ as coming in the flesh. This is the deceiver and the Antichrist. Somehow I've given myself 10 minutes to finish this. At the beginning of class, I joked by saying it was going to be your fault. And it's mine. I just can't get her done. So many deceivers have gone into the world, those who do not acknowledge Jesus is coming in the flesh. So people are deceiving others by this idea and teaching that Jesus didn't come in the flesh. And then he says, this is the deceiver and the Antichrist. So the deceiver cannot be a man of lawlessness as a person. I should clarify. The deceiver, you know, the Antichrist is not a man who we're still waiting to come. And we know that for two reasons. One, he said many have already come. And two, the Antichrist is the teaching that Jesus did not come in the flesh. Now, here's where this is important. Why would anybody teach that Jesus did not come in the flesh? Can't do it. Yeah. Yeah. Who is it that has the teaching of the Immaculate Conception? That Mary had to have a special little God bubble put around her because of her sin. Was that the Catholics? Oh. I mean, what's... The teaching that Jesus didn't have a body comes from the idea that the body is inherently sinful. So how can Mary be the blessed Holy Mother of God, right? So there's got to be some sort of God intervention there, right? Okay, and that's why the upholder is so high. And what I want you to see is this early teaching that Jesus didn't come in the flesh, didn't have a body like we do, is called Gnosticism. And Gnosticism is what became the Catholic Church. So what's happening is people are looking out and they're seeing sin everywhere. And they're coming to the conclusion that the entire creation itself is sinful. Anything physical is sinful. And because you are a physical creature with a body and you are of this creation, then you are by extension of your body a sinner. Okay? The sin, you know, the flesh is sinful. All right? So that's why the Catholics are sprinkle baptizing 3-day-old babies, because they believe that that baby is in sin. And if it dies, it goes to hell. Okay? Because it's got a body. Right? You and I would stand there and say, well, what has it done wrong? And they're like, well, that's not the point. It was born in sin. Okay? So they got to baptize the baby in order to save it. Okay? So that's the idea then, that because you have a body, you've inherited sin, is an extension of Gnosticism. The teaching that because you have flesh, that is sinful. Now, what do you do when the body is sinful? And that's what you believe. You go two different directions. You just accept it for what it is and sin till you win, which is modern day denominational Christianity, okay? Or you go the route of the Stoics who punish the body, right? Can you think of any priests who... or any other titles that start with P who wake up in the morning and whip them on their own selves in the morning to punish themselves? Anybody know who does that? That's the Pope. See, the body's sinful. It must be punished. Okay? It must be abased. We must forbid marriage. We must forbid foods. We must forbid pleasure. That's the Stoic. Okay? You see, if you take this idea that the body's sinful just because it's a body, you either just have to accept it and then sin till you win and then just sin so that grace may increase, and then you're a sinner, I'm a sinner, we're all sinner, you're not my judge, I'm not your judge. That's modern day denominational Christianity in America. The other route you can go is you can abase the body and you can punish it. And that's what the Catholics did. See, that's Gnosticism just morphing through. OK? Okay? So now I am, you know, at 13 years old, arguing with the Lutheran pastor about why does the 8-day-old baby need to be sprinkle baptized. Knew I wasn't going to win the argument on sprinkle baptism, so I asked the question, well, what's the baby repenting of, and how does the baby have the mental faculties to repent? Hasn't even heard the gospel, and his answer to me was, the child heard the gospel in his mother's womb when the mother went to church. You see how Gnosticism coming through into Catholicism, coming through into Lutheranism. Where did it go from there? I had a Calvinist tell me that the baby in her womb was a sinner. You see that? I had another Calvinist tell me that when Hebrews says Jesus was made like us in all things. And see, we didn't even get a chance to read it this morning, but we will. Okay? But Hebrews 2, I'll do this quick. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God. Okay. What's verse 14 say of John 1? And the Word became... Did Jesus have a body? And I haven't even got to Mark's comment, you know, why do they do it? Because they don't want to have to overcome it. Did Jesus have a body? It says the Word became flesh. And the Antichrist is anybody who would deny that. Now, why would they deny Jesus being in the flesh? Because they think the flesh is sinful. And if Jesus had flesh like ours, then that means he was a sinner. So they have to remove Jesus' flesh from him. The problem with that, and the reason why it's the apostasy, and the reason why it's the Antichrist, is because it destroys the entire foundation of Christianity, that you can overcome the old man. It destroys the new creation. And you're done before you even begin. They don't want to overcome the flesh. So they're just going to accept it, and then they're just going to go live in immorality. Or the other option, which is they know they can't overcome the flesh, but they still want to try to appease God, so then they just whip and beat and destroy and abase and destroy the thing. Don't eat certain foods, and don't, you know, and be celibate, and cut off parts of your body, and never get married, and that's your only two options. But the Bible's trying to explain to us that anybody who denies Jesus having a body, that's the Antichrist. You see that? And Hebrews 2 says he was made like us in all things. And the Calvinist said, all doesn't mean all. That was his defense. What? What? So my Gnosticism, okay, is... the entire creation, anything physical, is sinful. Gnosticism took two different approaches to that, which I'm trying to explain to you, which is just embrace it and just become completely licentious, or to abase it. Then, what did the Catholics do? They abased it, right? Made changes. Baptizing 8-day-old babies because it inherited its sin because the flesh is sinful. Right? Now I'm arguing with the Lutheran pastor who's the Reformed Catholic Church, right? And he's saying the same thing. And now I'm talking to the American Calvinist who's gone so far that now you're just completely depraved. And that the 3-month-old child in the belly is a sinner. Exact words. So the great falling away, the man of lawlessness, the Antichrist, that's how it happened. And that's how Satan's waging war. That's how the horn, it utters blasphemous things against God. I just, oh man, we just, here, we'll close here in Colossians. I think you see the picture, right? There's this great falling away. Man of lawlessness is going to be revealed. Okay, But this teaching and this great falling away, the seeds of it are already on the earth when the New Testament's being written. By 300 AD, it has fully taken root and the church is gone. Now, did that teaching disappear? What I'm trying to show you is that teaching is still here, alive and well, and it ain't just the Catholics. And you could go as far as to say, anybody who would say they can't overcome their old man, you're hearing seeds of Gnosticism coming through all of the denominations. You know, Rex is one of them guys that just asks really good questions in Bible studies. And I remember early on when we were talking, he said, you know, we were talking about overcoming sin. And, you know, his question was basically, you know, what's the answer to man's nature? And the Bible tells us that the old man, his nature, gets cut off, right? In immersion, in Colossians. Romans says he gets buried and put to death. You see, God took care of that old man, that sinner. Put him to death and put his spirit in you so that you can be spirit. So this teaching was here and alive and well. If you look at Colossians 2, Let's do verse 20. I should start in verse 16, but we're at the top of the hour. So he says, if you've died with Christ in your immersion, right? When the old man is put to death and the nature is cut off, right? If you've died with Christ to the elemental principles of the world, why, as if you were living in the world, do you submit yourself to decrees such as do not handle, do not taste, do not touch, which all refer to things destined to perish with use in accordance with the commandments and teachings of men? These are matters which have, to be sure, the appearance of wisdom and self-made religion and self-abasement and the severe treatment of the body, but are of no value against fleshly indulgence. It's already circulating when the New Testament is being written. These guys are teaching that the flesh is sinful. So Jesus couldn't have had a body because that would have made him a sinner. And we have to immaculately concept him in Mary's womb so he doesn't inherit that sin. That's Catholic teaching. Okay? And then because the body is so sinful, what are we going to do with the thing? Well, we're going to deprive it and we're going to abase it and he says here, we're not going to eat things, we're not going to touch things, we're not going to handle things, and we're going to severely treat the body. Like maybe cut off parts of your body. People do that, right? Swear to never get married, become a cardinal, and to never know a lady, right? These are all things that they're trying to do, right? To severely treat and to abase the body because they believe the body is inherently sinful just because it is a body. So that's what it looked like. It's morphed. And I'm just trying to show you these conversations I'm having just a couple years ago with Calvinists. I mean, it's still here alive and well, and it really has infected a lot of denominational thinking. So yeah, lots that could be said here. We'll see what we're going to do next week. Yeah, appreciate you guys' attention. Let's go ahead and break.